2015. The family does not watch the cremation process itself, but instead joins the reception upstairs. When the cremation is complete, they continue past the crematory to three rooms designated for the kotsuage. After the cremation, a fragmented but complete skeleton is pulled from the machine. Western crematories pulverize these bones into powdery ash, but the Japanese traditionally do not. The family walks into the shukotsushitsu, or ash-slash-bone collecting room, where the skeleton of their loved one awaits. The family are handed a pair of chopsticks, one made of bamboo, one made of metal. The chief mourner begins with the feet, picking up bones with the chopsticks and placing them in the urn. Other family members join in and continue up the skeleton. The skull will not fit into the urn intact, so the cremator might intervene to break it up into smaller bone fragments using a metal chopstick. The final bone, the hyoid, the horseshoe-shaped bone underneath the jaw, is placed in the urn last. In People Who Eat Darkness, a brilliant nonfiction account of two women murdered in Tokyo in the 1990s, Richard Lloyd Perry describes the funeral of an Australian named Carita Ridgway. Her parents had flown in to arrange the funeral of their daughter and were outsiders to the kotsuage custom. They made the long drive to the crematorium on the outer edges of suburban Tokyo. They said goodbye to Carita, who lay peacefully in a coffin full of rose petals, and watched her disappear behind the steel doors of the furnace. None of them was prepared for what came next. After a pause, they were led into a room on the other side of the building, and each given a pair of white gloves and chopsticks. In the room, on a steel sheet, were Carita's remains, as they had emerged from the heat of the furnace. The incineration was complete. Wood, cloth, hair, and flesh had burned away, but the biggest bones, of legs and arms, as well as the skull, were cracked but recognizable. Rather than a neat box of ashes, the Ridgways were confronted with Carita's skeleton. As the family, their task, a traditional part of every Japanese cremation, was to pick up her bones with the chopsticks and place them in an urn. Rob, her boyfriend, couldn't handle it at all, Nigel, her father, said. He thought we were monsters, even to think of it. But perhaps it's because we were the parents, and she was our daughter. It sounds macabre as I tell you about it now, but it didn't feel that way at the time. It was something emotional. It almost made me feel calmer. I felt as if we were looking after Carita. The kotsuage was not part of the Ridgway family's culture. Yet, at the most difficult time in their lives, it gave them a meaningful task to complete for Carita. Not all of the bones may fit in the urn. Depending on the region of Japan where Mom was cremated, the family might take the remaining bone and ash home in a separate smaller bag, or leave it behind at the crematory. The crematory staff pulverizes the leftover bones and places them in sacks, and then piles the sacks out of public view. When the pile is large enough, the pulverized bones are picked up by another specialized group, the ash collectors. From there, they are placed in large graves in the mountains, 8 by 10 feet and over 20 feet deep. According to the sociologist Hikaru Suzuki, the ash collectors plant cherry trees and conifers atop the ash pits. These cherry trees attract many visitors, but few of them recognize the secret of the tree's beauty. Cherry groves offer a more elegant solution than the old method. In the past, the ashes would simply be buried on the crematory property. But with the rise of fancier, park-like complexes, such as the Mizui Funeral Hall, the dumping the bones out back idea fell out of favor. Suzuki heard this group of ash collectors referred to as the Haibutsu Kaishusha, or literally, person who collects trash. According to her, the cremators look down on ash collectors for being mere manual laborers who have no responsibility for the spirit of the deceased. Having to deal with the corpse and the family is what makes a crematory employee professional. This was a strange distinction between the cremators and the ash collectors. In my years cremating, those two jobs were one and the same. The body goes into the machine as a corpse and comes out as bones and ash. In the West, where there is no kotsuage, families suffer great anxiety that they might receive the wrong set of ashes. They obsess over the question, is that really my mother in the urn? Yes, it's her. After a cremation, I attempt to remove every last fragment of bone or ash from the cremation machine. Nevertheless, some shards of bone fall into the cracks and are eventually collected into bags. In California, we scatter those bags at sea. I am both cremator and ash collector, both professional and collector of trash. When Sōjin Kato turned 111 years old in 2010, he became the oldest man in Tokyo. Officials came to his house to congratulate Kato on this impressive milestone. Kato's daughter would not let them in, alternately claiming that Kato was in a persistent vegetative state or that he was attempting to practice Sokoshinbutsu, the ancient art of self-mummification of Buddhist monks. After repeated attempts, the police forcibly entered the home and found Kato's body, which had been dead for at least 30 years and was long since mummified, but still wearing his underwear. Instead of honoring her father and bringing him to the grave, Mr. Kato's daughter had locked his body in a room on the first floor of the family home. His granddaughter was quoted as saying, "My mother said, leave him in there," and he was left as he was. Over the years, his 81-year-old daughter pocketed over $100,000 of his pension payments. What Kato-san's family did was astounding, not only for the length of their scam, but because it demonstrated how much the Japanese view of the dead body had changed. Traditionally, the corpse was seen as impure. Since the body was polluted, the family was expected to be active in performing rituals to purify and reset the body to a more benign and non-threatening state, imiyake, or lifting of pollution. To someone alive today, the list of rituals once performed to decontaminate both the living and the dead might seem endless. A list of highlights: drink sake before and after any contact with the body, light incense and candles so that the fire can cast out any contamination, stay awake with the body all night so no malevolent spirits enter the corpse, scrub your hands with salt after a cremation. By the mid-20th century, more people began to die in hospitals away from the home. More professionals in charge meant that Japan lost the sense that the dead body was impure. Cremation rose from 25% at the turn of the century to almost 100%. People felt contamination could be avoided by sending the corpse into the flames. The same shift occurred in the United States, but had the opposite result. It is disheartening that in the U.S., the professionalization of death care led to a greater fear of the body than ever before. Again, a gaze through the looking glass. In Yokohama, Japan's second largest city, you'll find Lastel, a portmanteau of last plus hotel, as in the last hotel you'll ever stay in, because you're dead. It's a hotel for corpses. The manager of Lastel, Mr. Suruo, didn't lead us through cobwebs by candlelight, as you might expect the proprietor of a corpse hotel to do. He was funny and outgoing, passionate about the facility and what it provides. By the end of my visit, I was whispering into my audio recorder, "I want it. I want a corpse hotel. I want one." Mr. Suruo led us into the elevator. "This elevator is not for the public, of course," he apologized, "just for the stretcher and the workers." The elevator looked so clean you could eat off the floor. We exited on the sixth floor, where Lastel had a refrigerated storage room that held up to 20 dead bodies. "I wanted something here that the other facilities didn't have," Mr. Suruo explained. as an electric stretcher shot down a metal track, floated under a white casket, lifted the casket from the rack, and delivered it to us at the entrance. The walls were lined with casket-sized metal doors. "Where do they lead?" I asked. Mr. Tsuruo motioned us to follow. We entered a small room with incense, some couches. There was an identical set of small metal doors in this room, though they were better disguised. A door opened, and in slid the white casket. We continued into three different family rooms, where, if you are a relative, you can come at any time of the day, the body is there on average for about 4 days, and call up the body from refrigerated storage. Your family member will be in the casket, their features lightly put into place with no embalming, and dressed in a Buddhist costume or a more modern suit. "Maybe you can't make the funeral," Mr. Tsuruo said. "Maybe you're working during the day, so you come by to visit and sit with the body." One of the family rooms was larger, with big comfy couches, a television, and copious bouquets of flowers. It was a place to hang out with the dead, in comfort, with none of the strict time limits imposed by an American funeral home. "It is 10,000 yen, $85, more to use this big room," he said. "Worth it," I replied. To have that period to visit the body as often as you like, no reservations needed, seemed graceful and civilized. Antithetical to the, "you paid for 2 hours in the viewing room, and you'll get 2 hours in the viewing room," rules of a Western funeral home. On another of Lastell's 9 floors was a bathing room, bright, clean, and white. There was a tall, elegant washing station for the last bath on this earth. The traditional Yukon bathing ceremony has, in recent years, been revived and performed commercially for close family members. The president of one company reintroducing the service said, "The bathing ceremony should help fill the psychological void in contemporary funeral ceremonies, because quickly taking the body away does not offer sufficient time for the bereaved to contemplate death." In my practice as a mortician, I've found that both cleaning the body and spending time with it serves a powerful role in processing grief. It helps mourners see the corpse not as a cursed object, but as a beautiful vessel that once held their loved one. Famed Japanese home organizer Marie Kondo expresses a similar idea in her mega bestseller, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Instead of purging everything into a garbage bag, she suggests you spend time with each item and thank it for its service before letting it go. Some critics found it silly to thank an ill-fitting sweater for its service, but the impulse actually comes from a profound place. Each separation is a small death and should be honored. This concept is reflected in the Japanese relationship with the dead body. You don't just let mother disappear into the cremation machine. You sit with her and thank her body and her for her service as your mother. Only then do you let her go. Mr. Tsuruo continued our tour by walking us down a cobblestone street, in actuality just a hallway in the Lastell building. The vibe was Victorian-themed Christmas display at the local shopping center. At the end of the hall was the front door of the house. Mr. Tsuruo offered us tiny covers to put over our shoes. "This is the living room type family funeral," he said, opening the door into a normal Japanese condominium, sadly not Victorian themed like the hallway. "So, is this just someone's condo, but no one actually stays here?" I asked, confused. "Yes, they stay here. You can have the whole wake with the body here." The condo had everything to make a family comfortable: microwaves, a big shower, sofas. Futon mats were available for up to 15 people to sleep on overnight. In a big city like Yokohama, actual family apartments are not large enough to accommodate out-of-town mourners, so the family can gather here to hang out with the body instead. This room flooded me with emotion and inspiration. There is a difficult discussion that rarely happens among American funeral directors. Viewing the embalmed body is often an unpleasant experience for the family. There are exceptions to this rule, but the immediate family is given almost no meaningful time with the body, which in all likelihood was swiftly removed after death. Before the family has time to be with their dead person and process the loss, co-workers and distant cousins arrive, and everyone is forced into a public performance of grief and humility. I wondered what it would be like if there were places like Lastell in every major city, spaces outside the stiff ceremonial norm where the family can just be with the body, free from the performance required at a formal viewing, spaces that are safe, comfortable, like home. History is filled with ideas that arrived before their time. In the 1980s, Hiroshi Ueda, a Japanese camera company employee, invented the first camera extender stick, allowing him to capture self-portraits on his travels. The camera extender received a patent in 1983, but didn't sell. The contraption seemed so trivial that it even made a cameo in the book of Chindogu, or Unuseful Inventions. Other Chindogu, tiny slippers for your cat, electric fans attached to chopsticks to cool off your ramen noodles. Without fanfare, Ueda's patent expired in 2003. Today, surrounded by the masses wielding selfie sticks like narcissistic Jedi Knights, he seemed remarkably calm in his defeat, telling the BBC, "We call it a 3 a.m. invention. It arrived too early." The history of death and funerals is also filled with ideas before their time. The Reapers own 3 a.m. inventions. One such creation arrived in 1820s London. The city at that time was hunting for a solution to the problem of its overcrowded and smelly urban graveyards. Stacks of coffins went 20 feet deep into the soil. Half-decomposed bodies were exposed to public view when wood from their coffins was smashed up and sold to the poor for firewood. This overcrowding was so visible to the average Londoner that Reverend John Blackburn said, "Many delicate minds must sicken to witness the heaped soil, saturated and blackened with human remains and fragments of the dead." It was time to try something else. Proposals to reform London's system of burials began to pour in, including one from an architect named Thomas Wilson. If land shortage was the problem, Wilson proposed that instead of digging further down to bury the bodies, London should send its dead skyward in a massive burial pyramid. This pyramid would be made from brick and granite and situated at the top of a hill, what is now Primrose Hill, overlooking central London. It would be 94 stories tall, 4 times taller than St. Paul's Cathedral, and hold 5 million bodies. I'm going to hit you with that number again, 5 million bodies. The pyramid would sit on only 18 acres of land, but would be able to hold the equivalent of 1,000 acres of bodies. Wilson's giant corpse pyramid, the actual name was the impossibly cool Metropolitan Sepulchre, spoke to Londoners' enthusiasm for Egyptian artifacts and architecture. Wilson was even invited to present his idea before Parliament. And yet, the public did not embrace the concept. The Literary Gazette labeled the project a monstrous piece of folly. The public wanted garden cemeteries. They wanted to push the dead outside the cramped churchyards of central London and send them to sprawling landscapes where they could picnic and commune with the dead. They didn't want a giant death mound whose weight might have crushed the hill, a monument to rot, dominating the city's skyline. All ended in shame for Wilson. His pyramid idea was pilfered by a French architect. After accusing his colleague of intellectual theft, he was sued for libel. But what if the idea for the Metropolitan Sepulchre was just the selfie stick of mortality, arrived before its time. Every giant leap we take to redesign death care comes with the caveat that the idea might end up in the pile with the other Chindogu. Just 5 minutes from the Ryogoku Station, right around the corner from the Sumo Hall in Tokyo, is one of the highest-tech funeral facilities in the world. On your lunch break, you can hop on the train, walk past the wrestlers in their patterned kimonos, and arrive at Daitokuin Ryogoku Ryoen, a multi-story temple and graveyard. Daitokuin Ryogoku Ryoen looks more like an office building than a typical graveyard. The facility exudes a corporate feel, starting with the neatly dressed public relations woman who met us in the lobby. She worked for Nichiroku Company, overall the third largest Japanese funeral company, but number one in the indoor cemeteries and graves market. "We are the pioneers of indoor facilities," she explained, "and the only large funeral company that is listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange." My DIY bias led me to identify more with the quirky, independent monk light-up Buddha team, but I had to admit that Nichiroku Company had discovered a market. In the 1980s, the price of land in Tokyo skyrocketed. In the 1990s, a tiny grave could go for 6 million yen, $53,000 US. The market was ripe for more affordable, convenient, urban options, say, a cemetery right off the train. Of course, being close to the train station isn't what makes the cemetery high-tech. The facility manager took us on a tour, starting with a long hallway with hyper-reflective black flooring and bright white overhead lighting. Lining each wall were individual pods with privacy coverings made of translucent green glass. The whole impression was that of a 1980s movie imagining the future, a design choice I endorsed. Inside the pods, behind the glass, stood traditional granite gravestones. Each stone had a rectangular hole at the base, the size of a textbook. Fresh flowers sat in a vase and incense waited to be lit. The manager took out a touch card, similar to the one used at the Ruriden Columbarium. Simulating what a family member would do, he touched the card to an electronic keypad. "The Sakura card recognizes the urn," he explained. Glass doors slid shut, hiding the gravestone. Behind the scenes, magic was happening. I heard the dull whir of the robot's arm as it plucked our urn from among 4,700 others. After about a minute, the glass doors opened to reveal the gravestone. The rectangular hole now contained the urn, with a family symbol and the name personalized on the front. "The idea is that many people can use the facility. We can store as many as possible," the manager explained. "The facility can accommodate 7,200 urns, and it's already more than half full. If you have your own grave at your own family cemetery, you have to change the flowers, light the incense. It's a lot of work. Here we do all of that for you." Of course, for the griever truly on the go, there is now an online service that allows for virtual grave visits. Another Tokyo company, ICAN Corp., presents a Sims-like experience in which your ancestor's virtual gravestone appears on a screen in a green field. The user can, according to taste, light a virtual incense stick, place flowers, sprinkle water on the stone, and leave fruit and glasses of beer. The president of ICAN Corp. acknowledged that certainly it is best to pay ancestors an actual visit, but "Our service is for those who believe that it is possible to pay their respects in front of a computer screen." The head monk at Daitokuin Ryogoku Ryoen, Masudo Jushoku, seemed permanently relaxed and, like Yajima Jushoku, had no problems with Buddhism mixing old and new ideas. As we left, he cycled away on his bike in full robes, talking on his cell phone. The facility was a partner project between his temple and Nichiroku Company. Years of planning went into the high-rise cemetery, which opened to the public in 2013. Well, you've seen the facility. What do you think of it? He asked wryly. It's more technology-based than any cemetery we have in the United States, I replied. And everything is so clean here, from the cemeteries to the cremation machines. Everything is cleaner and much less industrial. Well, dealing with death has become cleaner, he acknowledged. People used to fear the dead body, but we've made it clean. And then the cemeteries became like a park, neat and clean. Masuda indulged me in a long conversation about cremation trends in both Japan and America. We discussed how the Japanese were moving away from the kotsuage, in which the family personally removes the bones, preferring instead to have the facility's employees grind the bones down and scatter them. Traditionally, Japanese people are concerned with the skeleton, he explained. They perform the kotsuage, as you know. They like the bones. They don't want ash. Then what has changed? I asked. There are feelings that come with the bones. Responsibility for the soul. Bones are real, Masuda said. The people who scatter the ash are trying to forget, trying to put aside the things they don't want to think about. Do you think that's a good thing? I asked. I don't think it's a good thing. You can try to make death cleaner, but especially after the big earthquake, and with the suicide rate being very high, death has come closer. There are people who take their lives before the age of 10. People are beginning to think about death. You can't ignore it anymore. There was a time when the Japanese feared the corpse as unclean and impure. They have largely overcome that fear and have begun to see the body in the casket not for what it was, but for who it belonged to. Not a cursed object, but a beloved grandpa. The Japanese make an effort to integrate rituals with the body and ensure the family has enough time to spend in its presence. Meanwhile, countries like the U.S. have done the reverse. Once we cared for our corpses at home. Before the rise of the professional death class, we did not have the fear the Japanese had of the dead, and we valued the presence of the corpse. But in recent years, we have been taught to see the dead as unclean and impure, and the fear of the physical dead body has risen, along with our direct cremation rate. What's more, and what sets them apart, is that the Japanese have not been afraid to integrate technology and innovation in their funerals and memorials. We don't have a single space like Ruriden with its glowing Buddhas, or Daitokuin Rogoku Royen with its robot retrieval system. Our funeral homes are considered high-tech if they offer online obituaries or a photo slideshow during the funeral. If anything, the Japanese funeral market can prove to Western countries that you don't have to choose between technology and interaction with the dead body. Even better, you can offer both options to clients at your funeral home and not destroy your bottom line. And yes, more than ever, I want a corpse hotel. Bolivia, La Paz. Paul Kudinaris was wearing a large fuzzy hat made from a coyote pelt with the ears still attached. The hat, worn in combination with the gold beads that hung from his pointy black beard, made him look like Genghis Khan on his way to a furry convention. "I think Doña Eli will like the coyote hat," he explained. "She dresses her cat up like a Jedi." In Paul's mind, this was a perfectly reasonable connection. Doña Eli lived 3 blocks behind the back wall of La Paz's general cemetery, down a cobblestone street, in a nondescript home with a single threadbare sheet hanging in the doorway. Many residences on the street had similar features, corrugated roofs, wooden walls, concrete floors. But Doña Eli's was the only home that also had a rack of 67 human skulls, wearing matching cotton beanies, ready to grant favors to their many fervent devotees. The 67 skulls in Doña Eli's house were nietitas, The name translates to flat noses, or little pug-nosed ones, an adorable infantilization of a skull. To be a Nyatita is to have special powers to connect the living and the dead. As Paul put it, Nyatitas have to be human skulls, but not every skull gets to be a Nyatita. These skulls did not belong to Doña Eli's friends or family members. The skulls appeared to Doña Eli in dreams, alerting her to their presence. She went to collect them from overcrowded cemeteries, markets, archaeological sites, and medical schools. Doña Eli acts as their special caretaker, making offerings to them in return for help with everything from diabetes to debt. Doña Eli recognized Paul right away. He has been coming to La Paz to photograph Nyatitas for the past 11 years, and to recap, Paul is pretty recognizable. ¿Dónde está su gato? He asked. Where is your cat? Doña Eli and Paul share two cross-cultural connections. One, their obvious love of skulls, and two, dressing their cats up in costume. Paul pulled out his cell phone and began to show Eli pictures of his own cat, Baba, dressed as Saturday Night Fever, with a handlebar mustache, gold neck chain, and a permed wig, and Florence Nightingale, with nurse uniform and stethoscope. "Ah!" Doña Eli exclaimed in delight, recognizing a true kindred spirit. The skulls, on the other hand, wore identical cotton beanies, light blue in color, with their individual names embroidered on the front, like babies in a nursery. Ramiro, Carlota, Jose, Waldo, found him. These weren't their names originally. These names were bestowed by Doña Eli when the skulls became Nyatitas. Each one of Doña Eli's Nyatitas has a distinct personality and a distinct gift. Carlitos is the skull you'd visit for medical issues. Cecilia helps students studying at university. Seven of the skulls, including Maria and Cielo, were the skulls of children and infants, so they specialize in children's issues. The skulls had coca leaves in their mouths, and the crevices between them were stuffed with brightly wrapped candy. Other offerings made to the Nyatitas by their estimated 200 to 300 devotees included flowers, bottles of soda, and entire watermelons and pineapples. Certain skulls were considered the most powerful, the heavy hitters. Oscar sat on the top shelf wearing a police cap. Oscar was the first of Doña Eli's Nyatitas, acquired 18 years ago. "We had lost our house, had no work, no money," she explained, "and Oscar helped us to get back on our feet." Doña Eli can say with certainty that the Nyatitas work miracles because she has experienced the miracles for herself. Another powerful Nyatita was Sandra, and it was easy to see why. At least a quarter of Doña Eli's Nyatitas were not as much skulls as they were mummified heads, and Sandra was the pièce de résistance. She had one of the more elegantly preserved heads I have ever seen, chubby-cheeked and smiling. Leathery skin covered the entirety of her face, including her lips, which seemed to curl up in a jovial smile. Two thick salt-and-pepper braids wound down the sides of her head. Even her nose was intact, rare and hardly qualifying her as pug-nosed. In a feminist move, Sandra's specialty was financial negotiations and business. Paul came closer to take photographs of Sandra. "Ah, here," Doña Eli said, sensing he was trying to get a tighter shot. She pulled Sandra from the shelf and removed her Sandra beanie, revealing the full extent of the preservation. Doña Eli looked around, searching for an even nicer accessory for Sandra's close-up. As she went to fetch it, she handed Sandra's head to me. "Oh, yeah, okay, sure," I fumbled. When I held Sandra close, I could see her eyelids and a full set of light, fluttery eyelashes. If she had been acquired by a medical or history museum in the U.S., glass would have separated us. In La Paz, it was just me, and, alas, poor Sandra. Doña Eli returned with a tall white top hat for Sandra and plopped it on her head. Paul was snapping photos. "Okay, hold Sandra up closer to you. There we go," he said. "Caitlin, could you smile a little? You look so dour." "This is a human head. I don't need pictures of me grinning with a severed human head," I said. "Sandra's smiling way more than you are. Try to look a little less melancholy, please." After I returned Sandra to the shelves and we prepared to leave, I noticed a brand new set of teal embroidered beanies stacked next to the door. A woman, waiting her turn to consult with Doña Eli's netitas, explained, "Oh, they get a new color every month. Last month it was orange. These are the new ones. I like this color. It's gonna look good on them." Doña Eli has a significant collection of netitas. "I photographed charnel houses with fewer skulls than Doña Eli's house," said Paul. "But the most well-known netitas belong to Doña Ana." Full disclosure, I never actually saw Doña Ana. On the day we visited, a whole room of people were waiting around a huge cast-iron cauldron to enjoy an audience with her. Doña Ana's netitas speak to her in dreams, and based on your problem, she will tell you which of the skulls to consult. Jose Maria, Nacho, Angel, Angel Tu, and the very popular Honi. Each of Doña Ana's 24 netitas sat atop a glittering pillow in its own glass-fronted box. They wore safari hats with flowers along the brim. Cotton balls were stuffed in their eye sockets. Strips of tinfoil covered their upper and lower teeth, like metal mouth guards. "What is the tinfoil for?" I asked Paul. "To protect their teeth when they smoke," he said. "They smoke? Why wouldn't they?" The Roman Catholic Church, as a general rule, has never thrilled to the presence of the netitas in La Paz. In the past, priests presiding over the annual Fiesta de las Netitas have announced to the crowds seeking blessings that the skulls must be buried and should not be venerated. The first year Paul came to photograph the fiesta, people arrived to find the church at the general cemetery locked, with a sign saying they would not be blessing any skulls. The people protested, marching through the streets, holding their netitas in the air and chanting, "We want blessings!" The church opened its doors. The Archbishop of La Paz, Edmundo Abastoflor, has been a particularly vocal dissenter on the subject of netitas. "Well, of course he has," Paul scoffed. "The netitas embarrass him. They make it look like he doesn't have control over his own diocese." Women, like Doña Ana and Doña Eli, represent a threat to the Catholic Church. Through magic, belief, and their netitas, they facilitate a direct, unmediated connection to the powers of the beyond, no male intermediary required. It reminded me of Santa Muerte, the Mexican saint of death, who is unapologetically female. She carries a scythe, and her long robes are vividly colored, draped over her skeletal form. To the chagrin of the church, Santa Muerte's devotees have spread to the southwestern United States, coming north from Mexico, where she has tens of millions of followers. Her power is associated with outlaws, the poor, LGBT folk, criminals, anyone cast out from the stern bosom of Catholicism. We cannot single out Catholicism as the only belief system with a history of dismissing the agency of female devotees. Regardless of a woman's more egalitarian place in modern Buddhism, the ancient scriptures tell of the Buddha encouraging his community of male monks to take trips to the charnel grounds to meditate on women's rotting bodies. The motive of these meditations on foulness was to liberate a monk from his desire for women. They were, as scholar Liz Wilson calls them, sensual stumbling blocks. The hope was that charnel meditation would strip women of all their desirable qualities, so men would realize they are merely flesh sacks filled with blood, guts, and phlegm. The Buddha was explicit, claiming that a woman's deception is not in her accessories, like makeup and gowns, but in her fraudulent garment of flesh, surreptitiously oozing grotesque liquids from its orifices. Of course, these silent, decaying women of the charnel grounds were not permitted to have needs, desires, or spiritual journeys of their own to take. Wilson, again, explains that in their role as teachers, they do not utter a single word. What they have to teach is not what is on their minds, but what is going on in their bodies. The charnel corpses are mere objects, delusion busters for men to meditate on and thus gain the status of worthy. This was not the case at Doña Ana's, where women and their inner lives and problems were placed front and center. Nothing romantic, financial, or domestic was dismissed as a trivial issue. Her ñatitas were housed in a front room of her home, its walls covered from floor to ceiling in newspaper. Devotees had brought flowers and candles as offerings. Paul and I had brought white tapered candles, purchased from a roadside stall. I thought we would just hand over the candles as a gift, but one of Doña Ana's devotees insisted that we light them as an offering. Squatting on the concrete floor, Paul and I burned each candle on the bottom, melting the wax to get them to stand vertical on metal plates. They kept falling over as we made a mess of this task, narrowly avoiding an inferno. Since we had brought the offerings, I figured I had better talk to one of the ñatitas. I asked Nacho to influence the U.S. presidential election, which was being held the next day. I can only assume that either Nacho was not the right ñatita for American political matters, or was rusty in his English. A young woman sat among the ñatitas with a small boy in her arms. "This is my first time here," she admitted. "A friend told me it would help with university and to keep my boy safe. So here I am." At dinner one night, Andreas Badoya, a friend of Paul's and an artist from La Paz, warned me that I should not make the mistake of thinking we are a homogeneous culture here in Bolivia. His latest works are burial shrouds, each taking 5 months to create, handcrafted of leather, nails, and thousands of golden discs. The artisans of Bolivia are sometimes looked down on, as if what they produce is not real art. It is art, of course, and I let that inspire me. Andres creates his shrouds for museums and galleries. In creating this clothing for ghosts, he ritualizes his own grief and the grief of others. He wouldn't be opposed to actually burying someone in the shrouds, but has yet to do so. Bolivians may not be homogeneous, but funeral customs around La Paz tend to follow prescribed patterns. A solemn, day-long wake is held in the home or funeral parlor. Families hire a local service to deliver a coffin, along with crosses and flowers that light up and glow neon purple, the Bolivian color of death. Some people think the glowing purple is tacky or kitschy, but I love it, Andres admitted. Burial happens the next day. The coffin is carried for a block behind the hearse before it is loaded in and driven to the cemetery. Andres' mother died 22 years ago, and it was her wish to be cremated. Cremation in La Paz is growing in popularity, but until recently, it was challenging to effectively cremate bodies there. At 12,000 feet, La Paz is the highest altitude capital city in the world. The ovens couldn't get hot enough. There wasn't enough oxygen, Andres explained. Today's machines achieve higher temperatures and thus can fully cremate a body. Now that the technology is available, Andres considered exhuming his mother's body to honor her desire to be cremated. Unfortunately, the cemetery would require that he come to identify her exhumed body in person. Sure, I remember what she was wearing when we buried her, but I'd prefer not to have the memory of her bones. I don't need to carry that with me, he said. It was his interest in death that led Andreas to explore the culture of the Niatitas. November 8th is the Fiesta de las Niatitas, a chance for the owners of the Niatitas to bring out the skulls and display them. The party is not for the owners, but for the skulls themselves, making sure the Niatitas are esteemed and validated for the work they've done throughout the year. One tends to be very romantic and say the whole festival should remain untouched. But if it were completely untouched, you or I wouldn't be anywhere near it, Andreas said. Though unknown in most of the world, the festival has almost entered the pop culture realm here, he explained. The general cemetery, where the Fiesta de las Niatitas is held, was once the cemetery for the wealthy, but they have moved south. The city has made recent attempts at revitalizing the cemetery, commissioning murals by street artists on the sides of the mausoleums and encouraging local tourism. On All Saints Day, live theater is performed at night, and thousands of locals show up. The persistence of Niatitas in La Paz is due to the Aymara people, the second largest of Bolivia's indigenous groups. Discrimination against the Aymara was rampant for years. Until the late 20th century, it was assumed that urban Aymaran women, known as cholitas, would be denied entry into certain government offices, restaurants, and buses. I'll just say it, Bolivia is not a safe country for women, period, Andreas said. We are the poorest country in South America. We have a special word, feminicidio, that means a homicide where a woman is targeted and killed for being a woman, usually by a partner. There has been tangible improvement over the last 10 years. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, is Aymaran, and equality for Bolivia's many ethnicities was an important part of his platform. Cholitas are now reclaiming their identity, including their fashion, many layered skirts, shawls, and tall bowler hats balanced precariously on their heads. They are also entering public life, not as servants, but as journalists and government workers. At the end of Fiesta de las Niatitas, when the cemetery closes its gates, the cholitas perform folkloric dances through the streets on their way to different parties. Last year, their outfits, so tied to this notion of subservience, were printed with military camouflage. The men were pissed, laughed Andreas, who photographed the dancers. Folklore is not just historical in La Paz. It's contemporary. It's constantly innovating. Despite the increasing acceptance of the Aymara and the Niatitas, when Bolivians are asked if they keep a Niatita at home or believe in their powers, many will still say, oh, no, they frighten me. They don't wish to appear to be bad Catholics. There is still an underground aspect to the practice. Many more Bolivians, even the professional class like chiropractors and bankers, keep Niatitas than would ever admit to it publicly. The owners are practicing Catholics, though, Paul interjected. I have never photographed a house with a Niatita that didn't have a picture of Jesus or the Virgin Mary on the wall. That's part of why Bolivia is so weird, frankly, Andreas said. I was discussing with a friend recently about how we're not a blend of Catholicism and indigenous beliefs. They just got stuck together. He put the backs of his hands together, creating an awkward, monstrous shape. My sister's office still has a yatiri, a healer or a witch doctor, who comes in to cleanse the space. My father was a geologist, and when I was young, I used to visit the mines with him. On one of those trips, I witnessed the sacrifice of a llama because the miners demanded it. They wanted to keep El Tío, ruler of the underworld, happy. These strains of magic are still everywhere. The morning of November 8th, Jimena set her Disney tote bag, which depicted Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck playing soccer, on the concrete entryway outside the church at the General Cemetery. One by one, she pulled out her four nietitas, setting them up on a wooden plank. I asked her to introduce them to me. Her oldest skull had belonged to Lucas, her uncle. I mentioned that the skulls are usually from strangers, but sometimes they can be members of the person's family. He protects my house from robbery, she explained. Each of Jimena's natitas had its own woven beanie, crowned by a wreath of flowers. She has brought them to the Fiesta de las Natitas for many years. Do you bring them to thank them? I asked. Well, to thank them, yes, but really this is their day. It's their celebration, she corrected me. In the middle of our conversation, the front door of the church opened, and the crowd rushed through with skulls in tow, jockeying to get as close to the altar as possible. The newer attendees held back, tentatively waiting in the pews, but the experienced older women pushed their way forward and helped their friends send their skulls crowd-surfing up to the front. To the left of the altar, a life-sized Jesus sculpture lay in a glass box. He was bleeding copiously from his forehead and cheeks. His bloody feet protruded from underneath a purple sheet. A woman carrying a nietita in a cardboard chocolate wafer box stopped at his heels and crossed herself, and then pushed through the crowd toward the altar. Despite the contentious relationship with the Catholic Church, the priest standing in front of the crowd today struck a surprisingly conciliatory tone. "When you have faith," he said, "you don't have to answer to anyone. Each of us has a different story. This is a birthday celebration, in a way. I am happy we are all together. This is a small piece of happiness." A young woman, crammed next to me in the crowd, explained the priest's acceptance of the skulls this way. "The festival is so big now, even the Catholic Church has to bend." The skulls and their owners filed out from the two side doors of the church. At each door was a painter's bucket filled with holy water. Plastic roses served as aspergilla, sprinkling holy water onto the nietitas as they passed. Some nietitas wore sunglasses, others crowns. Some nietitas had elaborate altars built just for them. Others came in cardboard boxes. One woman had a baby nietita in a fabric lunchbox cooler. The nietitas got their blessing. Bolivia is not the only place where skulls have connected believers to the divine. The irony behind the church's disdain for the practice is that European Catholics have used saintly relics and bones as intermediaries for more than 1,000 years. The nietitas were similar in purpose to other skulls I had met several years earlier on a trip to Naples, Italy. "You are English?" my Neapolitan taxi driver asked. "Close." "Dutch?" "American." "Ah, Americana, where am I taking you?" "The Cimitero delle Fontanelle." Here I consulted my crumpled itinerary. "In Mater Dei via Fontanelle?" In the rearview mirror, I saw my taxi driver's eyebrows shoot up. "Catacombs? The cemetery? No, you don't want to go there," he insisted. "I don't?" I asked. Are they not open today?" "You are a pretty young lady. You are on holiday, no? You don't want to go to the catacombs. That's not for you. I'll take you to the beach. Napoli has many beautiful beaches. Which beach I take you to?" "I'm not really the beach type," I explained. "You are the catacomb type?" he shot back. Now that he mentioned it, I was. That is, if the catacomb type could be anyone other than a dead person. "Thanks, man, but let's stick with the Fontanelle Cemetery." He shrugged his shoulders, and off we sped through the winding, cobbled hills of Naples. To call Fontanelle a cemetery is deceptive, as it is really more of a large white cave, a tuff quarry, to be exact. Tuff is rock formed from volcanic ash. For centuries, this tuff cave was used to bury Naples' poor and anonymous dead, from the 17th century victims of the plague to the cholera deaths of the mid-1800s. By 1872, Father Gaetano Barbati made it his mission to arrange, stack, sort, and catalog the bones stuffed into the Fontanelle Cemetery. Volunteers from the city came to help and, like good Catholics, prayed for the anonymous dead as they piled skulls along one wall, femurs along another. The problem was the skull prayers did not stop there. Spontaneously, a cult of devotion sprung up around the unnamed skulls. Locals would come to Fontanelle to visit their pesintelle, or poor little ones. They would adopt certain skulls, cleaning them, building them shrines, bringing them offerings, and asking for favors. The skulls were given new names, revealed to their owners in dreams. The Catholic Church was not pleased. They even closed the cemetery in 1969, with the Archbishop of Naples decreeing that the cult of the dead was arbitrary and superstitious. According to the church, you could pray for souls trapped in purgatory, like these anonymous dead, but the anonymous dead had no special supernatural powers to grant the living favors. The living begged to differ. Scholar Elizabeth Harper pointed out that the cult of the dead was strongest and most noticeable during times of strife, specifically among women affected by disease, natural disaster, or war. The most important factor was that these women lack access to power and resources within the Catholic Church. This idea was echoed by Andreas Bedoya, the artist 6,500 miles away in La Paz, who described the Natitas as potent to those women whose connection with the beyond wasn't being properly managed by the Catholic Church. Vigilant though the Church may have been since reopening the Fontanelle Cemetery in 2010, the cult of the dead has not disappeared. Amidst a sea of white bone, dashes of color burst out. Neon plastic rosaries, red glass candles, fresh gold coins, prayer cards, plastic Jesuses, and even lottery tickets are scattered throughout the ruins. A new generation of the cult of the dead has found their most powerful pesintelle. By 11 a.m., the Fiesta de las Ñatitas was packed. The rows of graves were lined with blessed ñatitas, now accepting offerings of coca leaves and flower petals. Police patrolled the cemetery's entrance gates, checking bags for alcohol. Booze-related violence has led to the creation of new ñatitas. In the absence of alcohol, the skulls had to indulge in other vices. Lit cigarettes burned down to tar-stained teeth. "Do you suppose they enjoy the smoking?" I asked Paul. "Well, obviously they enjoy it," he said dismissively, before disappearing into the crowd, wearing his coyote hat. One woman danced with her ñatita to the raucous sounds of a live accordion, guitar, and wooden drum, thrusting this skull into the air and shaking her hips. This was the skull's day, his celebration. A man sat with the skull of his father. At one point, his father had been buried right here in the general cemetery. This forced me to wonder, if his father had been interred, how had his son gotten the skull back? The skull who now wore wire-rim eyeglasses and seven flower crowns piled high on his head. When I walked through the cemetery, there were empty graves, surrounded by smashed glass and hunks of concrete. Attached to the front of the tombs were yellowed pieces of paper with notices that read some version of "Final Warning, Mausoleum, 4th of January, to relatives of the late," insert name here. What followed was a message stating that the families had not paid the rental fees for keeping Dad's body in the mausoleum. As a result, he was getting evicted. Perhaps he would go into a communal grave, or perhaps he would return to his family, now skeletonized, to become a ñatita. As I crouched, examining a mummified ñatita, with its lip curled up in a distinct Elvis Presley sneer, a woman my age sidled up next to me. In near-perfect English, she said, "So, you're from the other side of the pond. You must be like, what the fuck is this?" Her name was Moira, and she came every year to the fiesta with her friend, who kept two ñatitas in his home. His first ñatita, the most powerful, came to him in a dream. In the dream, she informed him she would be waiting for him in the countryside. He went and found her and named her